From Alaska to Florida, California to New York, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, among the bellwether governor races this year are contests in Wisconsin and Texas. John Gizzi of Newsmax is here with part two of his look at key races across the country. The Empire Strikes Back. Congressional campaign committees are blacklisting consultants who work for challenger campaigns. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. And how is this for union excess? The SEIU wants an Illinois mother to pay union dues to care for her own son in her own home. Benjamin Yont has a Watchdog Radio report. And Barack Obama may turn to foreign affairs to shore up his collapsing presidency. That should worry conservatives. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Wisconsin, Texas, and Georgia all will be electing governors this year. Each race features unique political circumstances and larger-than-life political personalities. John Gizzi is the national political columnist and White House correspondent for Newsmax, and he joins us for the second installment of his look at key governor races. John, welcome back to American Radio Journal. John, we are picking up on the conversation that we started last week, talking about some of the key races for governor in various states around the country. A state that has really held the nation in fascination over the last couple of years is the Badger State of Wisconsin. Governor Scott Walker, recalled, became the first governor in history to survive a recall election. Now he's up for re-election. What did the chances look like for Governor Scott Walker?
I think the chances look pretty good. And remember, I was in Wisconsin covering the recall election, and on the day of the voting, no one I talked to was willing to say on either side what the outcome would be. As it turned out, he survived the recall by a bigger margin than he was elected governor, and all the talk immediately started Walker for governor. Now he faces a lesser-known and much less lesser-financed opponent in Democrat Mary Ellen Burke. Here's something I think that should be noted about Governor Walker. He is truly an agent of change and a visionary in the sense that he totally reformed the way that state pensions for public employees and health care plans are financed. In other words, state employees would have to pay part of the cost themselves. For this, he was challenged in a campaign fueled by organized labor, watched internationally, with correspondents from as far away as Britain and France coming to the Badger State. He survived. In part, this is because Governor Walker never says a harsh word about anyone. Within a day of claiming victory, he invited all the Democrats, their wives, and their staffs to the governor's mansion for a beer and brats, talk about things they could agree on. I have never heard him say a harsh word about an opponent or someone who criticizes him, and he has every right to. He is a total policy guy who looks ahead to things such as his Badger Care plan as an alternative to Medicaid. Is there little wonder that he's in such demand to speak around the country?
Scott Walker's being mentioned in the lofty group of potential candidates for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. Does he have the type of personality and positioning in Wisconsin that might play well in the Republican primaries?
Absolutely. And I've interviewed him at least a half a dozen times. I've been at press breakfasts, press meetings where he's been, covered him at the National Governors Association. And one sees in him a positive, upbeat, visionary look, not unlike that of the late Congressman Jack Kemp. One other thing that should be noted about him, no matter what the subject, he can turn it around to his own advantage. It was noted that if he's ever nominated for president, he'd be the first major party nominee since Barry Goldwater who didn't have a college degree. Why? The governor noted that in 3.5 years at Marquette University, he was always working for IBM, which lived up in his senior year, he said, to the initials that stand for I've been moved. When they left the state, one of their clients, the American Red Cross, offered him a job, but said he had to work for them full time. So he left college a few credits short of a degree.
Well, now another state, and it's always interesting in the great state of Texas. Governor Rick Perry himself, harboring presidential ambitions, longest serving governor in the country, is not running. So what is the lay of the land? It's a state that has been reliably Republican. Can we expect that to continue?
As George W. Bush once said when he was eulogizing the lady he defeated, former Democratic Governor Ann Richards, Texas is a state of larger-than-life political characters, and it certainly is in this race. With Governor Perry out, the state attorney general, Greg Abbott, has wrapped up the Republican nomination. He's a stalwart conservative on everything from abortion to voter ID to law enforcement. And he's also in a wheelchair, the result of a tree falling on him when he was jogging. And were he to be elected, he would be the first governor to be openly in a wheelchair as a candidate. FDR obviously concealed that he was in a wheelchair. George Wallace was wounded and forced to use a wheelchair after he was elected. Abbott is a candidate running from a wheelchair, and he would use that term himself. The Democrat, State Senator Wendy Davis, who made international headlines and drew tweets from all 50 states and a lot of money for her marathon filibuster wearing tennis shoes against the closing of abortion clinics under the aegis of Governor Perry. She became an overnight superstar. She wowed the National Press Club, where I saw her when she came to Washington, and she is the certain Democratic nominee. Now, Texas has not elected a Democratic governor in more than 20 years, 24 years since Ann Richards narrowly won, and she was ousted after one term by George W. Bush. Can Wendy Davis do it? Well, Bush himself said it best. Texas is a land of larger-than-life political characters. Two of them are running against each other now. This bears watching.
Speaking of characters who are maybe not larger than life, but certainly well known on the national scene, the Carters in Georgia, the governorship in the Peach State, is up for grabs this year. And we have a grandson of the former president running. Does he have a shot in what also is traditionally Republican territory?
Yes, he does. And I'm glad you brought that up, Loman. I've been a political reporter for more than 30 years. This will be my 35th year, in fact. And one thing I've noticed, that if you stay in the same job long enough, you see the same names coming up over and over again. I've seen generations of Kennedys, Bushes, Cuomos, and now it appears I'm going to see Carters. Jason James Carter, 39-year-old grandson of the former president, state senator from Atlanta, has wrapped up the Democratic nomination. Current governor Nathan Deal, like many Republicans, faces a primary and a challenge from another faction in the Republican Party, from Mayor David Pennington of Dalton, carpet capital of the world, I might add. He is running on the right, from the right, against Deal, moderate to conservative. Now, Carter would abjure the term liberal. When his grandfather called for universal abolition of the death penalty, State Senator Carter said, "I love my grandfather, but he's wrong on this one, and I support Georgia's use of capital punishment."
John Gizzi, who is the chief political correspondent and also the White House correspondent for Newsmax. You can read everything John writes at Newsmax.com. As always, John, thank you for being here, and we'll look forward to having you here from time to time throughout 2014 as we watch all these races unfold in states across America. Thank you again.
Can't wait.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye not only on what's happening under the dome in the nation's capital, but also politically around the country. Andy, always a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, we have all these elections that are coming up this year. We have members of the United States Senate, a third of that body, all the members of the House of Representatives. Obviously, there are going to be some intra-party races between Tea Party conservative challengers and establishment figures who are serving in Congress. This is starting to have some spillover effect on the consultant community. So can you tell us what's happening there?
It mainly started in the Senate, but the NRSC, the body that Republican senators had created to help keep incumbents in office, they have kind of made it known in the consulting community that a group called Jamestown & Associates has been effectively blackballed. And the reason why is because Jamestown is working with Matt Bevin, the conservative challenger to Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. And this is real thuggish behavior, and this isn't really about Jamestown. This is really about the NRSC and them pushing their weight around, all in an effort to keep incumbents in office and to suppress conservative challengers. The reason why this is news, this happened actually late last year in December or maybe even November. The reason why this is news is that the NRSC's sister organization, the NRCC, that's in charge of helping reelect House incumbents, has decided to blackball Jamestown as well. And this sort of thing has a ripple effect. It basically says if anybody works for any challenger against any Republican incumbent, you can expect to no longer do business with us. And that kind of thuggery is just outrageous. And I think that if more people in the conservative movement and in the grassroots were aware of this, they would recognize the establishment truly for who they are, which is that they value power above anything else, whether it's principles or doing the right thing. So this is something that I hope more people will talk about. Mark Levin's been great on this. He's been talking about it on his radio show, and I hope that just more people talk about it.
Is this something new? In other words, is this something that maybe has happened quietly behind the scenes in past years? But it would appear to me, Andy, from conversations we've had over the last couple of weeks and various things such as the U.S. Chamber putting money up against Tea Party candidates, that the establishment seems to be much more aggressive in its posture headed into this election cycle than in past years.
Well, yeah, you hit the nail on the head, I think, because they've always been doing this, but they've been able to quietly do it, and they've been able to effectively do it. And the reason why is because they had all the money, and nobody else did. But with the rise of outside groups like the Club for Growth and the Tea Party, we now have the ability to push back, and this has caught them on their heels. This is why the chamber, for the first time, is going to get involved in primaries to try and defeat conservative challengers. And this is why the NRSC is getting vocal about their blackball list. So they're using a playbook from yesteryear, when what they need to do is stand for conservative principles and allow these very healthy primaries to exist. But they've decided to use the playbook that they always have, and I think it's going to backfire on them. And a lot of money is going to be spent in a bad way, in a wasted way. But the key here is just to inform everybody that it's going on and to make sure that people know what the establishment is really doing. That's the key here.
Another interesting trend has developed so far this year, Andy, and that is a fairly significant number of retirements, and the pace of that appears to have quickened over the last week or two. What's going on there? Why are we seeing so many incumbent members of Congress deciding not to seek re-election?
Well, it's interesting. There are a lot of Republicans and Democrats who are retiring. You've got 15 in the House so far, and several just in the last week or so. Some of them are reasonable. They make sense. Like George Miller, a Democrat from California, he's been in Congress for 40 years. He's finally hanging his hat up. Same with Howard Coble in North Carolina and Frank Wolf. They've spent over 30 years in Congress. But what's really interesting to me is that there are a handful who are retiring after only two or three terms. Tim Griffin in Arkansas, who was elected in 2010, Bill Owens, same year. John Runyon, same year, from New York and New Jersey. And John Campbell, who's served a little bit longer than that. The most notably, Michelle Bachmann, who was elected only in 2006. They've decided to hang up their spikes, and it's obviously for different reasons for all of them. But the thing that I find interesting is just the number of moderate Democrats who are retiring, like Mike McIntyre and Bill Owens in New York. And I have to wonder if they are seeing something that the general public isn't seeing, which is maybe polling in their race that shows that Obamacare is really going to clobber them, and do they want to really fight that fight when the alternative is to become a high-priced lobbyist on K Street, which is not an exaggeration. It's probably something that a lot of them will do. So it's interesting, and we'll know more as the primaries reveal themselves this spring and summer and fall. But it's an interesting trend that I'm keeping my eye on.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 100,000 members from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and it's because we're united under the banner of economic liberty, lower taxes, limited government. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth of the Club for Growth. Andy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
How would you like to have to pay a labor union to care for your own child in your own home? That's what has happened to one Illinois woman whose case is now before the Supreme Court of the United States. Benjamin Yont has details on this Watchdog Radio report.
A very brave mom from Illinois is about to get her day in court. Finally. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I'm Benjamin Yont from Watchdog.org. Pam Harris is a simple mom. Like a lot of moms. Takes care of her family. Tries to keep up with the house best she can. She wants her child to live and be happy. Pam Harris's son, Josh, is profoundly disabled. Spends most of his time in a specially made wheelchair. And in Illinois, people with profound disabilities are allowed to live at home. They're not in an institution. And the government says parents who take care of these profoundly disabled children are entitled to some money from Social Security. But in Illinois, the government has also said unions, specifically the Service Employee International Union, should be entitled to some of that money as well. See, Governor Pat Quinn cut a backroom deal with the SEIU years ago that allowed SEIU to have an election to try and get what was called fair share. This is where if you work in a shop that is union, but you yourself are not the member of a union, you have to pay your fair share dues. This is a topic that has been discussed in states across this country. What makes it such a different case in Pam Harris's situation is that Pam Harris does not work in an institution for people with disabilities. She does not work for the state of Illinois. She does not even work for a private care provider that is paid by Medicaid. Pam Harris works in her own home, taking care of her own son. But thanks to this deal from Illinois Governor Pat Quinn, a Democrat, by the way, friend of organized labor, SEIU showed up at her home one day and through some rather shady tactics, oh, just sign this paper, let my boss know that I was here. No, that piece of paper actually said that Pam Harris agreed to let the union take part of her son's money for union dues. Union came back. Three times the union came back. Pam Harris finally had to go to court and sue. The case has bumbled and stumbled, rolled all the way up, and now next week the Illinois mom will have her case heard by the United States Supreme Court. And at issue are the merits of this case. Is it a fair share union dues case? Is it a First Amendment case where I cannot be forced to join a union to pay these fees? But this is seen by many people who watch the court as more than just the four corners of Pam Harris's case. This is seen by many people as a referenda on whether or not public employee unions will continue to grow in power, continue to grow in size and in scope, and continue with the government's sanction to run roughshod over taxpayers. I've spoken with Pam Harris a number of times. Very nice woman. She says all she wants to do is make sure that her son can be taken care of, can live a life. She does not think that it's right or proper or needed that SEIU come to her home and tell her how to do any of this. The law in the case is tricky. Illinois, thanks to its close association between Democratic lawmakers who control the state's capital and state government, have over the years allowed public employee unions to have free rein. Harris says not only is that just inherently not fair to taxpayers, but in her specific case, she does not work for the state of Illinois. She does not work in a state facility. She cannot negotiate with the state anything that deals with the care of her son. SEIU cannot help her son any way more than she can. But yet, because the state has decided to allow the union can come to her and say, no, you have to pay us or allow us to take part of your Social Security. If you go and throw Quinn v. Harris into Google, you will read all of the people who have signed in, filed briefs, the American Association of Peoples with Disability, the state of New York, public safety employees, the AFL-CIO, the NEA, the state of California, the home health care historians, the Mackinac Center, the Family Child Care Inc., the Illinois Policy Institute, the Cato Institute. This has long since become an issue of just Pam Harris, but she is so crucial to this case. One brave mom who stood up, looked the thugs from SEIU right in their purple and yellow shirts and said, I don't have to take this, and I'm not going to. We're not going to have a decision in this case for months. But as anybody who watches the United States Supreme Court can tell you, just listening to the questions oftentimes gives hints as to the answers. And I know that next week, I will be listening to those questions. Not just hoping Pam Harris gets to keep her son Josh at home and give him the best care that she can, but hoping that all of the Pam Harrises across this country can get a boost from the government against government unions. You'll be able to find more on Pam and her son Josh. See pictures, read their story. Find it at watchdog.org. I'm Benjamin Young. Thanks. You can always join the conversation. Find us on watchdog.org, on Facebook, on Twitter, and watchdog.org.
Second-term presidents generally look to foreign affairs to cement their legacies, and Barack Obama may be no different. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says on his American Radio Journal commentary, this is cause for concern. Colin?
Writing in the left-leaning political journal The New Republic, John Judas last month wrote an article titled, Only Foreign Policy Can Rescue Obama's Second Term. He opens by saying there is a pattern with second-term presidents that begins with Theodore Roosevelt and is fairly consistent. Presidents usually only make significant achievements in foreign policy. He goes on to say Barack Obama seems to be following this pattern. His domestic agenda has ground to a halt. His political legacy could be more negative than positive. And if he does anything outstanding in his second term, it will be in foreign relations. End quote. This is probably correct. In his first term, national security and foreign policy took a back seat to such domestic policy issues as health care, unemployment, economic stagnation, and skyrocketing federal debt. But his inability or disdain for the very kind of bipartisanship he promised in his first campaign have ground the Congress and thus the domestic agenda to a halt. He may try one more time to do something big on immigration, but after that, his lame duck status will be firmly established. If Republicans win control of the U.S. Senate this November, his only route to new domestic policy achievements will be through executive order, and there's a fast-growing belief that the kinds of things he wants to do through executive order are almost certainly unconstitutional. Seeing the domestic agenda of this man who in 2008 threatened to fundamentally change America, grind to a halt, should not bring much comfort to conservatives, however, because the lasting damage that he can inflict on America if he shifts his primary attention to foreign policy could be even greater. I'm going to identify a handful of first-term foreign policy actions that have had the cumulative effect of weakening America, and ask you, rhetorically, whether you believe that they were the results of Obama's inexperience or whether there's a pattern to them that might suggest something else. When he appeared to favor the Muslim Brotherhood in Iran while pressuring Israel to make additional concessions to the Iranians, was that simply the product of his naivete, or was it intentional? When he was unable to conclude a status of forces agreement with the government of Iraq and consequently decided to withdraw all combat troops from that country, was that because his negotiating team lacked the ability to strike a deal, or was it intentional? When he agreed to a troop surge in Afghanistan, but insisted that his price for doing so was the setting of a public date for their withdrawal, against the advice of virtually all military experts, was that the result of his lack of experience with or understanding of the military, or was it intentional? When he withdrew our Navy's aircraft carriers and embarked Marine detachments from the Mediterranean, was that the result of a near total lack of appreciation of the strategic value of naval forces in the 21st century, or was it intentional? When his efforts to curb Iran's nuclear ambitions through talks in Geneva appeared to many to be a modern version of Neville Chamberlain's 1938 Peace in Our Time, Munich Appeasement, was that because he didn't understand that outsourcing enforcement of the deal to the Russians was naive, or was it intentional? When he urged the Senate to ratify the New START Treaty, forcing the U.S. to reduce its tactical nuclear stockpile to no more than one-tenth the size of the Russians' stockpile of comparable nuclear weapons, was that merely naive, or was it intentional? Those are just a half dozen examples, but I think that taken together, they suggest that the pattern is intentional. Many of those who might have originally concluded that these serious foreign policy missteps were the product of naivete and inexperience are finding that such a position is no longer tenable. The evidence of a pattern of intentionality is simply too great to ignore. And that raises a much more serious question. If all of these policies were indeed intentional, what was the intention? Ronald Reagan believed in peace through strength. Can it be that Barack Obama believes in peace through weakness? Which of these national security postures strikes you as the more realistic? Which of them strikes you as the more dangerous? This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Please visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com and use the Contact tab on the homepage to let us know your view of the Obama foreign policy doctrine.
Thank you, Colin. American Radio Journal is heard on over 180 public affairs-minded radio stations in 45 states across the country. They include WKZI-AM and WPFR-AM in Denison, Illinois, along with WWJC-AM in Duluth, Minnesota. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.